This is Solidarity News on Radio Labour.
This is a Radio Labour World Report recorded on Friday, October 15th, 2021. I'm Mark Boulanger. In the report this week, labour and the global minimum corporate tax rate. Teachers are fighting to win vaccine equity for their colleagues around the world. The Label Start report about union events and...
Is it my accent? Because my hazel eyes and white thick thighs don't tell the story that my appearance hides?
This is Radio Labour. For years now, the labour movement has been calling on governments to implement a fairer international taxation system. A step closer to that goal was reached on October 8th when 130 countries agreed to set a minimum corporate tax rate of 15%. Large multinationals would be forced to pay taxes where they conduct business. To find out how the tax would be implemented and what the labour movement thinks of the new scheme, I talked to Pierre Abat. Mr. Abat is the General Secretary of the Trade Union Advisory Committee of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. The committee operates under its acronym TUAC. I asked Mr. Abat about the minimum corporate tax rate.
Alors, as we see today, globally, there is no minimum corporate tax rate. There are a few jurisdictions where the tax rate is actually at zero. In a majority of countries, the tax rate sits in the margin of 20-35%. But as we speak, there is no minimum tax rate.
But there has been an announcement of implementing a minimum corporate tax rate. Tell us about that.
Yes, a group of 130 countries agreed on a new framework that would indeed set a new minimum tax floor. This is the outcome of almost 20, 30 years of discussion at the international level. It actually stems back to a report of the OECD that was released in 1998 on harmful taxation that realized that the absence of a minimum tax rate, of a minimum tax floor, was creating a sort of tax race to the bottom. That report was released, but at that time, no action was taken. At the level of the G20, the group of the largest 20 economy, that there was a need to set a minimum tax floor. And this is what was agreed last week, a political agreement. This is not a legal text as we speak. It's meant to transform into a legal requirement, but there is a political agreement covering the vast majority of countries to set the minimum tax floor at 15%. That means that if it is implemented correctly, it will give a right, a secure right for governments to tax back, so to speak, to tax up to 15% in income, which from an economic perspective would fall under the taxing right of that government. So it's a minimum floor of 15%.
Why is a minimum corporate tax rate needed?
It is needed because if you don't have a floor, you are creating a very unhealthy tax competition between jurisdictions. We are in a system where business, and particularly wealthy individuals for sure, but businesses, can evade taxation by creating complex corporate structures and thereby evade the taxation of their income in the jurisdictions where it would make sense economically. By setting a minimum floor, you are not resolving all the problems on earth when it comes to aggressive tax planning, but at the minimum, you are giving less opportunity for aggressive tax planning, less opportunity for this unhealthy tax competition that takes place between countries, that takes place between, say, Ireland and the United States, that takes place between, say, Hungary and, say, the UK, between China and Germany, and so on.
How would this work?
It's a political agreement that would allow for a given government to increase taxation of a given business, which internationally, this business has an effective tax rate of, say, 10% because of the organization of its own business. It will allow for a government to add an additional taxing right of 5%, if it is 10% originally, to reach the minimum tax floor of 15% for the operations that economically fall under that jurisdiction. So, in a sense, we are not creating a minimum tax rate. We are creating a right for governments, a legal right for governments to tax back overseas profits that are profits that fall under that jurisdiction, to tax back those profits up to 15%. The next question is whether 15% is the right rate. Is it too low? And for the labor movement, for a number of unions, for NGOs, it is a floor that is far too low. It should be at the minimum around 20% and not 15%.
You mentioned the labor movement. Has labor supported the implementation of a minimum corporate tax rate?
Yes, absolutely. Unions will typically raise concern around three unhealthy forms of competition between countries, between nations, between economies. You have the competition on labor standards. This is our bread and butter matter, as we all know, is when you have a process of globalization with two economies with different standards when it comes to labor rights, and when you allow two different economies or markets to compete, and one of the economies obviously is not respecting the core labor standards. So that's one form of unhealthy competition. And that's a primary form that where the labor movement intervenes. You have obviously a second type of unhealthy competition is when you don't have any environmental flaws. And this is also part of the discussion today, making sure that in a global economy, economies can compete with more or less the same environmental standards, standards that are in line with the Paris Agreement's objectives to reduce gas emissions. And then indeed you have a third form of very unhealthy competition, and that's tax competition. So for the labor movement, it is obviously essential to fight on all three fronts to maintain and promote core labor standards at the very minimum and go beyond that, ensure a decent wage, sustainability and environmental standards, and also obviously to fight against this unhealthy tax competition.
Teachers around the world have found themselves not only fighting for quality education, but struggling against the often deadly effects of the pandemic. That is why Education International, EI, used this year's World's Teachers Day, October 5th, to intensify its efforts for safe working conditions and vaccine equity around the globe. EI is the global union for teachers and other educators. It represents 32 million union members in 178 countries. The General Secretary of Education International is David Edwards. He refers to the thousands of teachers who have died during the past year.
These are not numbers. They're human beings who lost their lives in service to their students and colleagues doing that which mattered most. The vast majority of them were unvaccinated, despite our demands to vaccinate all teachers. Many of them and many of their colleagues still are teaching under very difficult conditions. We pay tribute to them by continuing to fight for better, safer, and more dignified conditions that befit the people who teach the future. We pay tribute to their legacy as part of this whole, which truly is greater than the sum of its individual parts. In many countries, when you are at a school or union gathering or event and you name a teacher, leader, colleague that is no longer with us, the response is presente, present. When we pay tribute to the gift that their lives and their contributions have made, we say the present. We continue onwards, building on that contribution, remembering what we have learned from them and moving forward together about being present for one another.
The president of Education International is the Australian teacher Susan Hopgood.
Never has there been such a combined sense of accomplishment and uncertainty, of sorrow and optimism weighing on our hearts and on our mission as teachers. Educators have been present, adapting and improvising at the classroom and community level, working through their unions to forge and direct policies at the systems level, and managing the personal challenges unique to so many frontline workers. Through it all, teachers persisted and adapted and maintained our presence in classroom and the community. Likewise, our unions and allies and advocates have been clear about pushing forward on a comprehensive and sustainable path to recovery. We know there is no end to COVID-19 and no safe return to schools for all students without vaccine equity worldwide. As long as vaccine production falls short of meeting the global demand, we will continue to see new waves of the pandemic endanger the lives of our teachers and the future of our children. We know that countries where governments have engaged in meaningful social dialogue with unions have fared much better in the pandemic than countries where educators and their unions were not involved.
Here with his report about union events is Labour Start correspondent Derek Blackadder.
This week, our top stories section included links to coverage of the ongoing battle to free a Canadian trade unionist in Turkey and what's behind the charges he faces. Also amongst our top stories this week were the attack by fascists on the headquarters of Italy's largest trade union center, the CGIL. Later, we carried stories about the reaction of trade unions around the world, including planning for mass demonstrations of solidarity in countries like Spain, where trade unions also face hostile far-right political parties, some of which have their own paramilitary organizations. Days later, we were still reporting that CGIL's website was under a denial-of-service attack. This suggests a well-planned and strategic attack on the union with considerable backing and expertise. One story that has had a long, perhaps too long, life on our news pages are attempts by employers and governments to make grossly overworked and already underpaid healthcare workers pay the financial price for the pandemic. In countries from Paraguay to Portugal, from Cameroon to Canada, and from the United States to Uruguay, nurses and medical doctors' strikes are becoming common. By early next week, we may be seeing such strikes underway in as many as 25 or possibly even more countries. Demands for wage rollbacks or freezes are just the latest attack on these workers. In a great many instances, it is pushing even the most dedicated healthcare workers over the edge into taking action. Things are so bad that in many jurisdictions, healthcare workers are unable to take time off work and are resigning from their positions in an effort to get some rest. Those who remain at work are now being told that wage cuts are the way that their employers will cover the costs of the pandemic. For our Working Women page, our volunteers found more on the push for menopause leave in the United Kingdom, protests by nurses in Ireland over unsafe working conditions, and the workplace violence that women healthcare workers in South Africa face every day, and how their union is addressing the problem. Our Health and Safety Newswire carried stories about the renewed push to eliminate asbestos from buildings in the United Kingdom and in Zimbabwe, how COVID-related safety concerns are stimulating an increase in union recruitment in Canada, and sadly, another workplace shooting in the United States. Our photo of the week is of the attack on the CGIL offices in Rome. This is Derek Blackadder from Labour Start, reporting for Radio Labour.
Now here is Manuela Astudillo with My Accent.
Is it my accent? Because my hazel eyes and white thick thighs don't tell the story that my appearance hides? Is it my accent? Or is it the dust on my face? What dust, you ask? The one that seeped through my skin when I tried to rush in, all tight in the back of an illegal coyote car for 40 days with no water, no food, no air, and no way out. And just when I thought I had gotten somewhere, yes, I tell you somewhere because as a fact, I was in the middle of nowhere. I stepped out of that dark, dirty hole, and they took advantage. They took it all. They took my dignity, my identity, my money, but not my accent. And with this accent, I travel a journey from nowhere to somewhere to find the future that was stolen from my ancestors by the government of my new country. And even though that in this country some of you still laugh at me, because instead of saying party, I end up saying patty, I have an accent, and I recognize it. But here my people don't want their accents. They hide their culture and erase their past. They change their color to blind their eyes. But I have an accent. And even though that I can change my long curly brown hair to blonde and change the color of my eyes to green, blue, brown, pink, or red, I don't. No, I won't. And so I'll fight to protect the roots of my race through night and through day because I have an accent.
My Accent was produced by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union Canada, the UFCW. And that's it. International labor news you can use. You can listen to our features and daily newscasts at radiolabor.net. I'm Mark Bogosian. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about global solidarity.